Welcome to Valley Voices. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh. My guest today is Carbondale resident Barbara Dills, who is president of the board of directors of the Soper Sun and a freelance writer. She's lived in Carbondale since late 2011. But Barbara has also spent a lot of time on the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota for 40 years. She began going out there in the 70s during what I call the hot years for Native American issues. We'll get to that a little bit later. Barbara is also the adopted niece of Leonard Crowdog, who was a spiritual advisor during the 1973 Wounded Knee occupation and is a generational Lakota medicine man. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Thanks, Amy. I'm really happy to be here.
Talk about how you went to the Rosebud.
Well, I was just graduating from college, and I followed my college boyfriend out there. It wasn't anything particularly noble. I mean, I was pretty left-leaning, and I was a feminist, and so it wasn't that I was unaware of social justice issues, but I certainly had no idea what I was getting myself into. And he had gone out during the Wounded Knee occupation the year before, long before I knew him. So basically, he wanted me to go back with him after graduation, and that's what I did.
Talk about what it was like for you for the first couple of months.
I think I just thought I was going to have this romantic summer with my new boyfriend. And I ended up in the middle of an American Indian Movement camp, which eventually was an armed camp because we were being attacked. And Crow Dog's Paradise, which is where I went because that's where Eric had been connected, was really a center for young Indigenous people coming to try to understand what it meant to be Indian. Eric and I were pretty much the only non-Indians there consistently that whole summer. And, I went from being kind of a naive white girl to, getting a very rapid education in the history of our treatment of Native people in this country. And at the same time, I was just, learning to cook over a fire and feed hordes of guys who didn't have women there helping mm-hmm. them out. And mm-hmm. and I got really sort of brought into the Crow Dog family. And that was such a beautiful thing. And I got to participate in a variety of the very, very traditional old ceremonies, which they welcomed me to partake in.
Who are the Crow Dogs?
Well, the Crow Dog family is a well-known Sichangu family. And Sichangu is the Lakota name for the people who got put on the Rosebud Indian Reservation. So people may have heard of the Oglalas. That's the band that got moved to Pine Ridge when people originally got put on reservations, and the Hunkpapas were put on Standing Rock, and the Minikanjus were put on Cheyenne River, and it goes on from there. I'm not quite as good with the other band names. But anyway, so the Crow Dog family is kind of a storied family among the Sichangu people. And great-grandfather Crow Dog, as he's referred to, Jerome Crow Dog, was the first Indian to have a case before the United States Supreme Court, Crow Dog versus the U.S.
What was that case about?
So that case was about the murder of Chief Spotted Tail. It's a long story, but basically Spotted Tail was the chief that the federal government had identified as the one that they wanted to represent that band. And there were differences of opinion within the tribe about his role as the leader. And allegations that he had been selling young Indian girls to the cavalry guys and the government agents. And so anyway, he and Crow Dog had a standoff, and in the process, Spotted Tail died. So Crow Dog was charged with murder mm-hmm. and taken to Deadwood, South Dakota, where he was tried and was going to be hung. And somehow this white attorney intervened because the federal government really didn't have jurisdiction on the Indian reservation at mm-hmm. that time. Mm-hmm. And so his case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court agreed that the federal government did not have jurisdiction. So he was exonerated and allowed to go back, and the tribe handled it in the traditional jurisdictional way, which was that he was somewhat ostracized and also was responsible for taking care of Spotted Tail's family for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's quite an important case.
What year
oh gosh, 18, I don't have the exact date, but it was, I think in the 18, I'm going to say early 1870s mm-hmm. or 1880s. Mm-hmm. And Henry Krodog, who passed away in 1984, I believe, was instrumental in keeping the old traditional ceremonies alive when they were outlawed. So he was a roadman in the Native American church. He was also a Sundance leader. And he kept those ceremonies going when people couldn't, and mm-hmm. Basically carried them on way up in the hills on his land. And then he was instrumental in testifying before Congress to get the Freedom of Religion Act passed in 1978. And his son Leonard, who is my adopted uncle, mm-hmm. he was one of the two primary spiritual leaders inside the Wounded Knee occupation and was one of the main spiritual leaders in the American Indian movement in its early years. Amy, I'm just going to say one more thing about the Krodog case that's so important for people to know, and that is that as a result of Jerome Krodog being able to go back to his people, the U.S. Congress convened and passed what's called the Major Crimes Act, and that is why the federal government has jurisdiction today on Indian reservations for what they consider major crimes, and those are felonies. So it's one of the reasons why so many young Indian men in particular who get caught up in the criminal justice mm-hmm. system, they don't do time in state prison systems like a white person with the same charges would. If Indians commit major crimes, felony crimes, on Indian reservations, they immediately go into the federal system. And that is a direct result of the U.S. Congress overriding the treaties and creating the wow. Major Crimes Act.
You know, I want to set a little bit of context here. About a decade from 1969 to 1978, I call those the hot years of the American Indian movement. I mean, those were the years of the Alcatraz occupation from 1969 to 1971, which was basically the emergence of the American Indian movement onto the public stage. Then there was the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs occupation in Washington, D.C. There was the 1973 occupation of Wounded Knee, which is what you were talking about, to bring attention to the conditions at the Pine Ridge Reservation in Indian Country. Then there was the incident at Ogallala in 1975 when two FBI agents and Joe Stuntz, who was a Native American, were shot to death. And that began the lifelong imprisonment of Leonard Peltier. And then finally, in 1978, this is finally to me, I mean, there was a lot of other stuff going on too, but these were sort of the big milestones here. The 1978 Longest Walk, when Dennis Banks and other American Indian Movement or AIM members organized a walk from Alcatraz to Washington, D.C. to protest threats to tribal lands and water rights. And that was, to me, the decade of the American Indian Movement. You know, there was Dennis Banks, Russell Means, John Trudell were the mouthpieces of the American Indian Movement. There were a lot of other people who were doing a lot of work, but those were the guys who were pretty much associated with that. So that's sort of the context in which you were going back and forth from the Rosebud.
That's right. And I would say that, you know, I went through such an interesting process in a period of months there. I mean, I was always sympathetic to what was going on and very aware as I learned more about what Wounded Knee had really been about. But we were harassed on a daily basis at Krodog's.
Harassed.
Throughout that summer of 1974, and it went on and on after that, harassed by local goons, you know, local guys who were basically being, you know, paid in beer or whatever to cause trouble to the traditional people. And the Krodog place represented the center of kind of, you know, traditional Lakota values mm-hmm. on the Rosebud Reservation. And because it had been the staging area for supplies to go into Wounded Knee during the longer occupation the year before, even as a lot of murders of traditional people continued on the Pine Ridge Reservation, it all kind of spilled over to Rosebud, which is just to the east of Pine Ridge. So I got a very quick kind of on the ground, hands-on, both an introduction to the most extreme poverty I had ever witnessed, even though I had worked for a day camp in the South Bronx in New York, and you know, I wasn't totally naive, but a level of poverty I had personally never experienced. So I had my eyes opened on that level. I had my eyes opened to how our government was trying to basically suppress this movement, but also force traditional people to assimilate and give up their old ways just through wearing them down and killing them off, actually.
Wearing them down.
Well, when you, and this is something I think the people at Standing Rock are really experiencing right now, and that is that when you are under constant surveillance and harassment, it wears you down. You know, I went to sleep at night in a tent with the sound of sniper fire in the hills above us firing down on our camp. I mean, I realistically could have been shot there. And we had 24-hour armed security at a certain point. And, you know, I'd hear the guys walk by. I'd wake up, and they'd be shuffling by my tent, walking the perimeter of the camp. And so it does. It puts you in a certain frame of mind and on edge, and it wears you down, and it wears the old people down.
Right. What do you think has been their greatest strength, because they haven't been worn down?
They are just such a resilient, determined people, but also I really think the strength of their traditional cultural and ceremonial ways is what has kept them strong. And I see a real resurgence in that area. And I think Standing Rock is also a reflection of that.
Talk about that.
I mean, I still go back to Rosebud. I have for 40 years, 8 times in the last 2 years. And I just see a re-embracing of the language and the culture that is even stronger, sort of more widespread, not just among the traditional full bloods, but also just among the tribe as a whole. And I can only really speak about Rosebud, and I can only really speak about my experience. But for example, my adopted sister, who grew up with Lakota spoken all around her and definitely has always understood it, she used to be too shy to try to speak it.
Wow.
And now when she calls me, she always greets me in Lakota. And just in those small ways, and she's trying to make sure her grandkids get introduced in that way.
Because there's such power in language. And I think that's, I don't know. It's so hard for me to talk about this because I don't want to be the non-native expert talking about Native Americans, but I know that language is power, and to my way of thinking, that could be where the Native power is coming from, is just remembering their language.
And really, that all goes back among Lakota people in some ways. That pride was generated in a public way by the Wounded Knee occupation and everything that was fomenting at that time. And so I do think there's this important kind of cord that connects that time and those efforts and why the American Indian Movement was called to Pine Ridge in the first place.
Talk about that.
Well, it was actually, I mean, as I've heard the story told, and I'm just reflecting what I've heard, I certainly wasn't there at that time, but it was actually primarily, you know, instigated by a group of middle-aged and older women on Pine Ridge, who some of whom had experienced, you know, direct violence toward their families
from Dickie Wilson's goon squad.
From at the time, the tribal chairman at Pine Ridge, Richard or Dick Wilson, was very corrupt and also, you know, very much a pawn of the federal government in terms of trying to, again, you know, pull people out of that traditional mode and also out of their commitment to living on the land. And that gets us all into resource extraction and all that. I mean, that was all behind it. But anyway, there had been just blanket harassment of the traditional Lakota-speaking, more full-blooded people who were trying to maintain their old ways by Dick Wilson and what he eventually called the Goons, which stood for Guardians of the Oglala Nation. But they weren't really guardians of all the people. They were guardians of what in the old days they used to call the hang around the fort Indians, you know, the more
progressive, so to speak.
The more assimilated, people who were more apt to want to toe the line and follow the current federal policy and so forth. So anyway, these women got together as things had escalated and the harassment had escalated and people were being murdered and those murders were not being investigated. And they basically called out the men and said, what are we going to do here? And at that time, you know, Dennis Banks had helped start the American Indian Movement and Vernon and Clyde Belcourt in Minneapolis. And Russell Means had connected with them. And anyway, so they were actually asked to come and help.
I want to remind listeners that this is Valley Voices on this Thanksgiving Day. Happy Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving, Barbara.
Thank you, Amy.
My guest is Barbara Dills, who is president of the board of directors of the Soper Sun and a freelance writer, but she also has lived on the Rosebud Reservation on and off for a long time, and she is the adopted niece of Leonard Crow Dog, who was a spiritual advisor during the Wounded Knee occupation in 1973 and a generational Lakota medicine man. You know, I'd like to talk about the relevance of the 1973 occupation of Wounded Knee to the Dakota Access Pipeline struggle. Is that a relevant comparison?
It's very relevant in the sense that I think there's a cord of historical connection between the two. Mm-hmm. And, of course, some of the remaining leaders who have not passed on from the Wounded Knee occupation have been very visible at Standing
Rock.
Dennis
Banks has been out there.
Dennis Banks has been there. Leonard Crow Dog has been quietly up there advising people kind of behind the scenes, I know. And so there's that connection, and there's sort of a spiritual connection between the two in that I think there's still quite a lot of pride in Lakota country about the impact that Wounded Knee had ultimately on improving conditions for traditional people and the traditional cultural values. And so I think there's that sort of, this is just my own impression.
Sure.
That there's that connection. And I haven't been to Standing Rock, and I wasn't myself at Wounded Knee. I was just there in the wake of it.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also differences. And I think one of the important, or evolutions, if you will, and one of the important things I think that has made me so hopeful about this Standing Rock movement is that back in the 70s, you know, essentially the tribal government at Pine Ridge was squelching the spirit that was trying to protect the land and the water and the people. There was a huge division between the traditional people, or people trying to adhere to their traditional Lakota values, and those who were in power in the tribal government.
Okay.
And I've been so impressed by the involvement and support and everything of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which of course is called Sioux Tribe because that's the federal name for them. It's not their name for themselves. But anyway, and Dave Archambault, who's the tribal chairman there, who's so articulate, but obviously also very much committed to a traditional Lakota way of protest and of speaking out. So there's a different energy because there's not that division within the tribe. And then we see all the other bands of the Lakota coming together as they did to stop the Keystone Pipeline, that they're all standing together again like they did, you know, back in the 1800s.
150 years ago.
Right. But as was not true necessarily during the 70s. So I think that's an important, I'm not going to call it a distinction, but it's an important evolution.
Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, we're almost out of time. And I really appreciate your taking the time to come in on Thanksgiving and talk about this issue and your experience with it. This is a huge weekend at Standing Rock. Jane Fonda is supposed to be out there, and there are, I would imagine there are thousands of people out there. I've heard anywhere from 4,900 to 12,000 people at camp, so I really have no idea. The Osheti-Sakowin camp is governed by seven council fires and is governed in the traditional way. I don't have any right or knowledge to talk about that because that's not who I am. But I do know that, as you were saying, the gathering of these nations is unprecedented in our generation. There are also non-natives out there. I've been out there. I'm a non-native. I covered the Labor Day dog attacks and that sacred site desecration. And I went with somebody who was bringing some supplies. It was a very small run, just the two of us. And then I left. We left. But I'm not sure I want to go back because I worry about the non-natives co-opting this demonstration, this gathering. What are your thoughts about that idea?
I would leave that in the hands of the spiritual leaders at the Osheti-Sakowin camp and among the tribal leaders. I think there are so many spiritual people there from the tribes that they will manage that. And so I think if someone feels called to go, whether no matter what race they are, then they're called to go. And if some of us feel hesitation to go for some of the reasons you just said, well, then we probably aren't supposed to be there right now. I've been at many, many Sundances at the Crow Dogs place. More and more non-Indians have come. Sometimes they come in the right spirit. Sometimes they don't. And I always witness that everything gets taken care of in the right way. That's kind of where I come down on it. At the same time, anybody who goes should go in the spirit in which the Standing Rock Sioux tribe is asking them to come. So nobody should go with drugs or alcohol or firearms or intention to for self-aggrandizement or, you know, so you have to think hard about why you're going, and you have to be willing to work. And I have some words, actually, from Leonard Crowdog, and I think it speaks to what you just asked. And so I found this quote from a book by Roseanne Dunbar Ortiz called The Great Sioux Nation, Sitting in Judgment on America, which was published in the 70s. He said, "We socialize ourselves with the bird called eagle and the earth, the sacred water. They are all sacred things that evolve, that the Creator made in this earth. It does not belong to only one nation, but it belongs to all human beings that live in this world here."
Thank you. Barbara Dills, I'm really grateful that you spent some of your Thanksgiving with me here at KDNK. And thank you for your experience and your words.
Thank you, Amy, for having me, and happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
Happy Thanksgiving. You've been listening to Valley Voices. I'd like to end this show with a new song from Montana-based singer-songwriter Sharon Iltis. Thanks for listening.
This song is dedicated to the people of Standing Rock. May my courage be so ever strong as to stand up for what I feel in my heart. That is the very core of my own survival.
Let my stage be a rock out on the edge of the lake, so I can sing to the waves and the lines that they make. Let me strum to that rhythm, oh, everlasting sail. Let me strum to that rhythm for everlasting sake. Let my stage be a mountain that I climb to the top, so I can breathe in the freedom of the winds wild and brave. Breathe in that. be loved. Let my estate be family as we sit down to eat, so I can feel my heart warm with love's gentle beat. Let me hold on to that love for everlasting sake. Let me hold on to that love for everlasting sake. Oh, oh, let me listen to a standing rock. Let me learn to hear a river's love from the sun, like a mother's tears.